Michael Noonan, the director of FPRI's Program on National Security, and welcome to another installment of FPRI Radio. Today we are honored and delighted to have with us Michael Horowitz on to discuss his recent National Bureau of Asian Research piece entitled How Defense Austerity Will Test U.S. Strategy in Asia. Mike is an FPRI Senior Fellow, as well as an Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. The author of the award-winning book, The Diffusion of Military Power, Causes and Consequences for International Politics, Princeton University Press, 2010. His writing has appeared in policy and academic outlets such as International Security, Orbis, Security Studies, and the Washington Quarterly. In the past, he has conducted research for the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment, and in January 2013, he will begin a prestigious one-year Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellowship in the Department of Defense. Mike, welcome. To begin, can we have you give us just a short rundown of your basic argument?
Hey, well, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to do things for FPRI. And this piece really focuses on the link between ongoing debates about the defense budget and the implications for American strategy in the Asia Pacific. As you know, over the last year, the United States made a decision to focus or, you know, refocus American defense efforts in Asia, with the idea being that as the, you know, the war in Iraq is now wound down and the war in Afghanistan will, you know, is in the process, beginning process of winding down, that a lot of the largest challenges to the United States come from Asia. And thus it makes sense to refocus American efforts toward the Asia Pacific. The problem is that doing this essentially requires money, because the types of equipment and resources that you need to maximize American capabilities in the Asia Pacific, they're different in some ways than the capabilities you need for wars in the Middle East. And we're also in the process of cutting the defense budget. There were about $500 billion in cuts over 10 years as part of the last budget cycle. And if defense sequestration happens, and by that I mean if Congress can't agree on a broader deficit deal by the end of this year, there'll be another $500 billion in defense cuts. And my piece lays out what the implications of that might look like, and I think they would be pretty devastating to American power projection capabilities in Asia. The United States is currently investing in a new strategy called Air-Sea Battle. It's an operational concept that the Air Force and Navy especially are using to try to combat and defeat some of the area denial, anti-access capabilities that countries like China are developing. These are capabilities like anti-ship missiles, cruise missiles, submarines, designed to make it so expensive and difficult for the United States to project forces into Asia that the United States will decide to, you know, and hope, you know, it would decide to withdraw instead, that the game wouldn't be worth the candle. Air-Sea Battle is an operational concept designed to prevent that from happening, helping us rebalance our forces toward Asia. The problem is that to implement Air-Sea Battle, the United States needs to invest in a bunch of capabilities. The United States needs to upgrade its Virginia-class submarines. It needs to spend a lot more money, at least in my opinion, on research and development for the next generation of weapon systems, and it needs to fund legacy platforms like the F-35. The challenge is that because of the way the Budget Control Act of 2011 is written, defense austerity in the form of sequestration could force automatic cutbacks across the defense budget, meaning even really high priority areas of the defense budget, such as Air-Sea Battle, could be placed at risk. And the implications then could be a much more challenging environment for the United States, an environment where it's a lot more difficult for American forces to project power, maybe not next year or the year after, but certainly, you know, 5-10 years down the road, along with longer term implications as well. The thing that I'm actually the most worried about is funding for research and development for the next generation of systems. It's really easy to think about the defense budget politics here. If Congress has a choice between cutting things that may work out in the future and defense industry production lines that could produce jobs now, like the F-35, you know, we all know what they're likely to choose. But this research and development money isn't just pie-in-the-sky technology. there are investments in cyber, in robotics, and other areas that can really pay dividends down the road. And the risk for the United States that other countries aren't standing still. You'd never want to be in a position where America's lead in things like manned fighters and carriers becomes a liability because the U.S. doesn't invest enough in the technologies that will be relevant, you know, 20, 25 years down the road. And one of my biggest concerns is that defense austerity could not only undermine our ability to implement air-sea battle now, but could hurt our ability to make sure that America remains the preeminent military power in the Asia-Pacific and the world over the next generation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a very interesting piece that you wrote, and I agree with much of it. One question, though, I do have is that on the issue of R&D, I agree with you in the main, but there is kind of a question about fungibility of skills. In other words, if you don't have the production lines open now, kind of how do you maintain the skill sets that are needed for die casting, for other things, for the workforce, in order to take advantage of that in the future when you do kind of come up with breakthroughs in technology? So don't you see as kind of a, there's a little bit of a seesaw going on there about in order to maintain some of the defense industrial base now for sort of future kind of what thoughts or opinions might you have on that sort of argument?
I actually agree with you completely. Let me rephrase. Maybe I explained myself poorly. I think that my argument is not that we should, you know, not buy the F-35 or not buy Virginia-class submarines. In fact, I think the Virginia-class in particular is critical, as is the F-35. It's that the pots of money that go to research and development are so much smaller than the pots that go to procurement of systems now. But I think that their knock-on effects are really large down the road. And so I think we need to be careful. Obviously, we do not want to gut the defense industrial base, because you're absolutely right. If we just spent money on research and development, then we would lack the capacity to build all of these new weapon systems down the road. But I think we need to make sure, even as we do cutbacks, that we do them in a way that doesn't sacrifice the future. And maybe that means cutting back in some other areas, or maybe that means we end up with you know, maybe one or two less F-35s. I'm not saying that's necessarily a good idea, but I think that we just need to make sure that we don't end up, you know, not investing in the capabilities that won't be, you know, not just for the next war, but say the war after next.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, history has proven that we're very bad at predicting the next threat. So R&D, I think, certainly is a worthy area to look in, especially as we perhaps move from sort of the labor-intensive conflicts that we've been facing over the last decade and sort of refocus some defense investment on some of the more capital-intensive systems, aircraft, and shipbuilding in particular, that has sort of been a little bit neglected over the past decade.
Think about something like the X-47B, the drone that's designed to launch and recover to aircraft carriers. That's the type of technology that could potentially be a game changer for the United States and Asia to ensure American superiority, you know, 15, 20 years down the road. We just need to make sure we're still investing in those capabilities, you know, if defense austerity happens. I mean, I think the good news here is that this is an issue that I think both parties, regardless of their differences, are aware of and will do their best on. The problem is that their hands could be tied if there's not a broader budget deal.
But you kind of think that that's probably something that's going to take place after the election, though, that both sides are kind of playing this cool for political purposes, and then they realize whatever outcome happens in November, that they need to do something there, or else there really will be kind of, you know, bipartisan, agreed upon, you know, massive cuts to defense, which I don't think either party really wants, particularly right now. In the current economic situation where a lot of people might be out of work.
And I'm certainly no expert on American politics, but it seems obvious, at least to me, that there's no way these issues really get resolved before the election. I don't think that Congress or the executive really has the stomach for them. I think it's much more likely that these things get addressed in a lame duck session of Congress, or at worst, right when the government returns to action, essentially in early 2013. I think one of the problems, though, is that the debt deal that led to the Budget Control Act a couple of years ago illustrated, the particular group of Democrats and Republicans that are in Congress now seem willing to take things right up to the edge if they think it's going to give them a political gain. And, you know, in essence, you know, both sides essentially are toying with America's national security, and that's something that's very dangerous.
Yeah, I agree with that. Why don't we take a step back from sort of domestic policy, domestic political considerations, and look at the so-called pivot to Asia and some of the actions that have taken place. We've put Marines now up into Northern Australia, where there's talk now about perhaps reshifting some forces from Okinawa out to Guam and to other places. Talk about maybe putting a sea base in off the coast of Okinawa, and also issues relating to sort of some Japanese domestic political considerations about stationing things like the CV-22 Osprey there, due to some people point to a safety record, other people point to pilot error and other things. But
right.
How do you feel mainly about the administration's policy towards East Asia, and do you think that it's a feasible strategy, kind of how you could look at it as the United States is kind of the eagle and China is the dragon, and obviously not a declared threat, but certainly a challenger in East Asia, particularly recently with its actions in the South China Sea, perhaps testing out sort of the reaction of governments in Manila and elsewhere about some territorial claims. How do you feel in general about how the administration has handled East Asia policy?
I actually think the administration has done a pretty good job with East Asia policy, and this is an area where I think there's actually a lot of bipartisan agreement. People are going to say whatever they're going to say during the campaign, but I think if you look at the second term of the Bush administration and then this term of the Obama administration, I think you see a lot more continuity than differences, in that I think over the last 8 years, the United States has tried to work to bolster its alliances with our friends in Asia, and has sought to be, I want to say, prudent about the challenges that the rise of China can lead to, while also being careful, not to, spark, too many fears of containment, since, certainly you don't want to create a self-fulfilling prophecy, a situation in which you treat China like an enemy and then it makes them more likely to become an enemy. But you also don't want to be in a situation where you don't take the rise of China and what that will mean seriously. And I think the administration has done a pretty good job of balancing between those things, of trying to communicate that we wish for China to be a responsible stakeholder in the international system, but we are ready to act, to stand up for international law, to stand up for freedom of the seas in a place like the South China Sea, and we're not going to allow them to push American allies like the Japanese and the South Koreans around.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. I think Kirk Campbell has actually done a pretty good job on East Asia policy during this administration.
In full disclosure, I used to work for Kirk, so that probably not the least source in the world on that.
Yeah. No, I think in general, I think you... you make a pretty good argument about that. It's not really particularly, unless people are separated at sort of ideological poles, I think that that's pretty sensible argument. Well, Mike, I want to thank you very much for being on with us today, and I wish you the best, and I'll see you around the office at some point.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, you're welcome.